Last Sunday evening, Bev was speaking about the central theme of this letter, about the fundamental importance of finding our justification in Christ and in Him alone. She spoke about different groups of people who were arguing, often strongly, for a faith plus approach. Yes, faith in Jesus was important, but they taught that you needed something else as well. Obedience to the law, and so on. And Bev listed three or four things that they were saying, this is what you need to do in addition to believing in Jesus. And this is what Paul was arguing so passionately against, as he argued that faith in Jesus was all everyone needed and what everyone needed. And then in the next two chapters, chapters 3 and 4, which we're looking at briefly this evening, Paul goes on to provide more details as he picks up argument after argument and shoots them down. It's as though he's saying, well, you might argue this, but actually that doesn't work. Or you might say this, but that's wrong. And he does that time and time again in these three chapters, trying to look at every aspect of what they're saying and saying, well, actually, that is not how it works. As I alluded to in our prayers a moment ago, next week, Theresa May will be sending a letter on our behalf to the authorities in Europe, those who run the European Union, to formally advise them that we will be leaving. I don't think it's going to come as a big shock to them, but it's important as the start of the legal process. Now, for some reason, I have not seen a draft of the letter she's going to send. But I expect, as well as the short statement, "Dear Mr. Tusk, we are leaving," there'll be lots of details talking about various issues, outlining some of the things that she wants to discuss, some of the things that she wants to ensure are addressed properly. There'll be a lot of supporting stuff around that core central statement. And that's similar to what Paul is doing here. He's outlined the heart of his message. Now he expands on it by looking at different aspects of what is going on in Galatia and what is being taught. We've read sort of the beginning of that and the end of that, but there's a lot of stuff in between. So I'm going to briefly summarise the key points Paul makes in these two chapters and then look at the passages we read in slightly more detail. So, in chapter 3, verse 1 to 6, Paul refers to the conversion experience of the Galatians when they received the Spirit of God as they believed in the crucified Jesus. He reminded them that this was an experience that they had gone through. They had met with Jesus in a powerful way. He had changed their lives. They had believed in him. God had poured his Spirit into their lives. And he asked them to consider how that happened. Was it through belief in what they heard? Or was it through doing what the law said? In verses 7 to 9, he refers back to the story of Abraham, a man who is characterised as the man of faith, somebody who had faith in God and to whom God promised that all nations on earth would be blessed through him. And he reminds them that it is on this basis, and this basis alone, this basis of faith, that people come under God's blessing. In verse 10 to 14, he refers to the curse that everyone who seeks to follow the law is under, and how it is only Christ who is able to free people from that curse. In 15 to 25, Paul takes an everyday example of a legal agreement, a covenant, a contract, and how you can't just set it aside when you don't like it anymore. And he uses this to argue that the introduction of the law, which was given by God to Moses at Mount Sinai, didn't set aside the faith-based agreement between God and Abraham, which had been put in place 430 years before. In verse 26 to verse 11 of chapter 4, Paul picks up the idea of being a slave, then being set free and adopted as an heir. Think of somebody who had lived all their life up to that point with no freedom, with having to do everything that you were commanded to do because you had no rights, you had no ideas, you had no choices of your own. And then you're set free. and you're taken into the family in which you're working, and you are told by the head of that household that you are now an heir. You are part of the family. And Paul is using that to say, this is how it used to be. You used to be under the bondage of the law, but now you've been set free in Christ through the work of the Spirit. And he says, how on earth can you be willing to go back to that old relationship? That relationship of slavery, that relationship of bondage, instead of enjoying the wonderful liberty of being a freed child of God. In chapter 4, 12 to 20, Paul sort of moves to a personal note, and he pleads with them to listen to what he's saying, to trust him and to stay true to what he's taught them. And then in the last passage, which Andy just read to us, Paul refers back again to Abraham, and this time uses the example of Abraham's two sons to get to the people to think about the choice of which of two systems they want to live under, that of slavery or that of freedom. There are some common threads in these chapters. And one of the things we see is Paul continually goes back to the story of Abraham and the agreement that God made with him through faith, and argues that it is only through faith that we can come into a relationship with God. And the basis is no longer the law that God gave to tell people how to live, but it is rather the transforming, redeeming work of Christ made available to them through the work and the power of the Spirit. And we'll look at those in a bit more detail as we look at those two passages that Sue and Andy read to us. But first, I want us to think about whether we, not just us here, but the church in general, run the risk of doing something similar to what was going on in Galatia today. Not that we're liable to get caught up in discussions about whether we need to be obedient to the Old Testament law, whether we need to become converts to Judaism in order to be in a relationship with God. But there are other things that people can get hung up on that causes them to look for something other than simple transforming faith in Jesus. I was speaking with someone recently about the teaching of the church that he goes to, which says that the act of baptism is necessary for salvation. That it is only at that moment of baptism that one becomes a Christian. Now, I believe that baptism is important, and I encourage people to be baptized whenever possible. But this position is adding to the need for faith in Jesus and puts too much emphasis on that important sign of commitment. We can say, or we can suggest by some of the things that we do or some of the things that we say, that some people aren't welcome in our churches if they don't know the right words, or if they don't know how to behave in the right way. We expect particular behaviours before we accept them as authentic Christians. And while it is right and proper to look for evidence of the Spirit's work in people's lives, we shouldn't insist on them conforming to particular traditions that the church has introduced over the centuries before we can accept them as people who have a desire to meet with God. We can become so sure of particular beliefs as being essential that we forget that they're based on long-term practice and not what the Bible actually says. Some of the things, some of the challenges that has caused problems for people and for the church over centuries. Paul is not arguing here, and I'm not arguing here, that it's not important to build on the foundation of faith in Christ. It is important to grow from that. And Paul, in other places, points out some of the areas of growth that are important. But what he's arguing here, and what he argues for very powerfully when he writes to the church at Corinth, is that there is only one foundation. And that foundation is based on faith and belief in the person and work of Jesus Christ. When we start mixing other things into that foundation, we've got things wrong, and we risk losing the freedom that we've been brought into in Christ. So, with those thoughts in mind as a sort of introduction, let's look at a bit more detail in the passages that we read a few moments ago. And we'll look at both of them with reference to what they say about Abraham, as he is pointed to as the great example of faith. So in the first passage, in 1:3-14, Paul reminds the believers of their conversion experience. He points back to the story of Abraham, and he speaks about the way in which believers can be set free from the curse that they find themselves under from the law. Abraham is mentioned 5 times in this short passage, and each mention adds to our understanding of what Paul is saying. In verse 6, we are reminded of the time when Abraham is spoken of as having believed God, and God calling him righteous as a result. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. This is referring back to something that happened in Genesis 15. And God had just spoken to Abraham and said that he was going to have an heir. He was going to have a son. And that his descendants, who were going to come through that son, were going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky. Some of you know Joe and I have just come back from Tenerife. And one of the things we were able to do was to go out in the clear night sky at the top of a mountain, another mountain than the one I was talking about this morning. It was all to do with mountains in Tenerife. We went up onto this mountain and in a clear night sky, and we looked at the multitude of stars. And we had a guide who could point out, well, that star is that, and that star is that. And it was interesting. They have a big focus on cutting down on light pollution in that part of the world. And it was possible to see much more than we can see here. And as Abraham looked up into that night sky, before any of the stuff that we've invented that stops us seeing the stars properly, he would have seen that amazing sight of uncountable stars. And he was faced with the promise that his descendants would similarly be unmeasurable. He knew that he was childless. He knew that there was no hope, naturally speaking, for him to have a child. But God said, and he believed. And that simple act of faith was all that was needed for God to call him righteous, because he had believed in what God had said. Here, Paul is reminding the Galatian believers that when they took their own simple step of believing, they became part of that great multitude who had descended in faith from Abraham. They were part of that family that spans all of time and crosses all nations. And if they'd missed the point, he spells it out clearly in the next verse, that everyone who has this faith in God is a spiritual descendant of Abraham. Those who have faith are children of Abraham. Verse 8 reminds us of another occasion that God spoke to Abraham. The first time that we're aware that God spoke to him. God had previously told Abraham that all nations on earth would be blessed through him. If you're familiar with the story of Genesis chapter 12, you will know that God calls out to Abraham and says, I want you to go. I want you to go from where you are. I want to leave your family. I want to leave your friends. I want to leave where you're living. I want you to go somewhere. I'm not going to tell you where, but I want you to go. And I'll sort of give you a few directions along the way. And Abraham was prepared to go. And then in Genesis 12, verse 3, God gives this promise of bringing blessing on every nation on earth through Abraham. Up until that point, in Genesis 1 through 11, humanity had found many ways to mess up. We were pretty good at it, even then. Disobedience to God resulted in Adam and Eve being put out of the Garden of Eden. There was jealousy. There was murder. There was such an extent of wickedness that God sent a flood to get rid of most of humanity. There was drunkenness, there was pride, there was trying to set themselves up in a way that seemed to sort of rival God. It wasn't, in many ways, a pretty story. And now God is stepping in and saying, through this one man, this man he has chosen, he is going to bring blessing on everyone. God is starting again. And he was going to do so through this man of faith. In verse 9, Paul goes on to speak about the importance of relying on faith, just as Abraham did, and entering into the same sort of blessings that he experienced. Those who rely on faith are blessed along with Abraham. Relying on faith. This is often something that is so hard to do. We want to contribute our own abilities, our own efforts to what God has done, instead of being prepared to accept his promises in faith. This is what was being dangled in front of the eyes of the Galatian believers. And this is what Paul was encouraging them to resist. And I wonder if it is something that we need to hear tonight. Are there things that we are trying to add to what Jesus has done for us to make us acceptable for God's presence? Are we, on the other hand, content to live as people of faith, who from that position of simple and total faith in God, then go on to do great things, not to earn his favour, but because he has poured out his blessings upon us? And then the last time Abraham is mentioned in this passage is in verse 14, where Paul is reminding them again of what Christ has done for them. He redeemed us, he says, from being under the curse of the law by being prepared to become cursed for us. That's in verse 13. And he did so that the blessings promised to Abraham could flow out to Gentiles, to non-Jews, to people like us. The Jewish faith had lost its way. It was no longer focusing on how it could become a blessing to the nations, but how they could live as God's separated people, distinct from the nations. People did see how they were living, some were attracted to it, and they were converted to Judaism. But what Jesus has done is opened the floodgates and allowed God's mercy to flow out to everyone, irrespective of race or status or gender. And Paul summarizes that towards the end of chapter 3, where it says in verse 28, "There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Paul is reminding the Galatian believers that they had been brought into Abraham's faith family through the work of Jesus on the cross and through the transforming work of the Spirit in their lives. And it was important for them to hold on to that and not to seek to add to it in any way. And then, after the other bits that we mentioned, he draws his argument to a close at the end of chapter 4. And as he does so, he goes back to Abraham and speaks about his two sons. Verse 22 and 23 tell us that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and the other by the free woman. His son by the slave woman was born according to the flesh, but his son by the free woman was born as the result of a divine promise. This was the story that the Jews of Paul's day would have been familiar with. And Paul uses it to make a powerful, and I would suggest surprising, argument. For those not familiar with the story, Abraham's wife Sarah couldn't have children. And after quite a long time of living in this state, she gave Abraham her slave girl to try and have a son with. A strange arrangement to our understanding, to the way in which we think of things. But a common practice in those days. Depending on who you read, some people suggest that it may have been required for Sarah to do this. If she hadn't been able to give a son to Abraham after a certain period of time, it was essential that he have a son and an heir, so she had to find some other woman for him to have a son with. It was one of her responsibilities as a wife. And so that's what she did. And so a son, Ishmael, was born to Abraham and Hagar, the name of this other woman. Then some years later, 13-ish years later, God made it possible for Sarah to have her own child. And so the son of promise, Isaac, was born to Abraham and Sarah. And so, knowing about this story and confident that the people he was writing to would know about this story, Paul goes on to refer to key moments in the history of God's people. He speaks about the time that God gave the law to his people at Mount Sinai, where they went after they escaped from Egypt. He speaks about the establishment of Jerusalem as their capital city and the place where they would meet with God. And that was such an important place in their thinking. It was the place where the temple was. It was the place where they had to go every year to worship and to offer sacrifices and to meet with God. It was the centre of their worship. But instead of linking these events, the giving of the law, which sort of made them the people that they were, the establishment of Jerusalem as the centre of their nation, Paul shockingly turns the tables and says that these are linked to Hagar. They are the things that have brought people into bondage under the law. They are not things that give them freedom. This was not what the people would have expected. It'd be even more shocking than someone predicting that Jeremy Corbyn is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. You heard it here first. It was so wrong. It was so unexpected. It would have brought people up short and caused them to think, hang on, what on earth is Paul saying? In what way are those things that are so essential to our understanding of what it means to live in relationship with God, are they bringing us into bondage? And to bring his point home, Paul goes back to the story of Ishmael and Isaac and reminds his readers of the time that Ishmael was seen to be mocking his younger half-brother. Isaac was about 1 year old, having a big party to celebrate, and Sarah happens to see Ishmael having a go at Isaac, and she's not happy. And she says to her husband, "Get rid of them. I don't want them to have anything to do with our family ever again." They were not participants in the blessings that God had promised. That's the point that Paul is making here. If the believers at Galatia were to fully experience the blessings that God had for them, they had to get rid of, they had to reject those who were seeking to draw them back into bondage to the law. It was only then that they could experience the fullness and the freedom of what God had done for them through Jesus. As I say, the things that might drag us down, that might trip us up, are not, I expect, questions about how we engage with the Old Testament law, about whether we become Jews. But are there things this evening that we are relying on, that we are trusting in, that are not based on what Jesus has done for us? Things that maybe we feel comfortable with. Things that we think, well, actually, we can sort of add a bit to that because we've got this ability, we can do that, and so on and so forth, that we can contribute something. And what Paul is reminding them, and what I think Paul is reminding us, is that actually, in terms of establishing our relationship with God, we can add nothing. That is all down to what Jesus has done. It is all down to the transforming work of the Spirit in our lives. And anything else that we're relying on to draw us into relationship with God has to go. So if there are things that we're trusting in, let's be prepared to let them go. Let's be prepared to step out, maybe in a bit of uncertainty, and to trust completely and totally in Jesus, and to experience the freedom and the liberty that he offers to the people of faith, the people who've entered into the blessings that God promised to Abraham. And we remind ourselves that to Abraham, God made that promise that through you, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And we, if we're just prepared to accept our status of people of faith, people who are spiritual descendants of Abraham, then we enter into that as well. That because of our simple and total faith in Jesus, we can go on and we can go out to be a blessing to every nation on earth. I'm not suggesting that the 20-odd of us here this evening has to go and be a blessing to every person on earth. That could be an interesting challenge. But we are part of a great people of faith that spans the world, who are called to be a blessing to everybody who is not yet in a relationship with God. And for each of us, the way in which we work that out will be different. It might be with our families, it might be with our friends, it might be the people that we work with. People with whom we can share, people with whom we can seek to share the blessings that we have entered into. And we can do it because we trust completely in Jesus, knowing there's nothing we can add, knowing nothing we need to add to what he has done. And in that knowledge of freedom, we can go out and be people of faith who bless the world.